Hello, and welcome to a return edition of the PBT podcast. We've been gone for a little bit, but we are going to be back now and through the playoffs and then through free agency and the fun part of the season, talking all things NBA. I am Kurt Helan, the managing editor of Pro Basketball Talk at NBC Sports. I'm here with Dominic Ridgard from NBCSports.com. How's it going this morning, Dom?
Great, Kurt. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. We are taping this on a Tuesday morning after what was a very entertaining Monday night game, surprisingly. I think a lot of people thought, you know, this might be the one where Houston rolls over, but that team doesn't do that. And, of course, then it became the Steph Curry's injured game, which was kind of the main story, because if he were actually injured, that would have been, like, the story of the playoffs. But fortunately, he bounced back. And, Dom, it ended up being a game where Houston, if you've watched them through the playoffs, you had to know they were going to come out with some fire. They have not rolled over for anybody. I mean, the great comeback against the Clippers, this is a team with some fight. And then it became this, well, they're up by 20. All right, so it never felt safe. Like, you just kept waiting for the Golden State run because you knew they would have one.
Yeah, absolutely, Kurt. You know, it was one of those things where after the game when you kind of refocus and you realize Steph Curry's okay, you look back at it, and even though Houston had a commanding lead for a lot of the game, it was always entertaining, especially because Golden State could shoot so well. You never felt like they were truly out of it. And you look back, and it was one of those games where Golden State, even though they lost Steph for a little bit, they kind of found themselves, the shooting started to drop, and just at the end of the day, James Harden was just a little too much for the Warriors.
Yeah, I could say it. What's interesting in that game is that if Curry was actually like minus 20, it was they were actually, you know, better. That happened to be better that night just with him off the floor. Great game from Klay Thompson, who started off horribly and then kind of did his LeBron, like, oh, I'm going to be bad for a bit and then I'm really going to turn it on. And he had numbers. And like you said, what's dangerous about that team is that no Curry, Thompson starts slow, and you still are just like, yeah, but they're going to come. You know, you know it's going to start to fall, and it did. They started to get some stops. They started to get some turnovers. But I think that was what was key for Houston. They really effectively played at a real high pace for one of the first times in this series. I mean, they got some stops early. They turned that into early offense, and then, hey, this is what happened against the Clippers, too. When Josh Smith is hitting walk-up threes, you know it's going to be their night.
Yeah, there's not much you can do on that guy. And it's funny, too. He's one of those guys where his threes, when he makes them, they're actually kind of pretty. I feel like I've never seen him rattle in a three. It's always either he straight drains it or he barely hits the rim. That guy's an enigma unto himself.
Yeah, and he's up to about 37 or 38% now, almost 40, through the playoffs. Like, this is a guy who the book on him is let him shoot the three, but I think you're at the point now in these playoffs where you've got to at least contest him a little bit. You've got to make him you can't just give him the wide-open three, which is what their strategy has been for a while. Like, oh, no, hey, he wants to shoot. Go ahead and shoot. He's now knocking it down at a rate that you, at least through these playoffs, that you've got to respect him a little bit with it.
Especially in that first quarter. I thought he really set the tone for that team that, you know, win, lose, or draw in those kind of situations, you at least want to go out swinging. You know, you don't want to be tentative. You don't want to be timid. I'm going to do what I can to win this game for my team, or at least help contribute to a win. And if the shots don't fall, they don't fall. But I'm not gonna pass up open shots because I'm worried about the result. That's what you want to see. And a guy like Josh Smith, oddly enough, he's almost the perfect guy for that scenario. You know, I'm not worried about the shot I'm going to take. I'm going to take the shot I want if I feel like I'm open and I feel like it's going to help my team. It's actually he's an interesting player to watch, man, for sure. But, Kurt, real quick, I want to get your thought on the Curry injury specifically because that, like you said, in the moment, that's what that game became about. You know, from when he got hurt, from when he left, he even said it was about an hour real time when you consider halftime. That, you know, it was one of those things where the game almost became like the background noise to the Steph Curry watch.
Especially since especially since the series is pretty much decided anyway. I mean, good on Houston for winning this game, but I don't think anybody expects them to actually come back and take the series.
It's
frightening only because if you started, I mean, that was a nasty-looking fall. I mean, especially the way his arm got pinned at a kind of strange angle. That didn't seem to be the problem. You know, he's walking, when you saw the video of him walking back down the hall, that concussion was the first thing I thought.
Because, oh, for like, sure.
Man, look at him. He looks dazed.
He was out of it.
Yeah, and if he's that, you know, any, fortunately for, I guess, for them in the concussion state, that they're, you know, they're going to have a ton of time off between now and the finals. But if you're going, you know, even in that situation, if he's gone for any length of time, it completely changes the Warriors. It completely changes the dynamic of everything in the postseason. It was, you know, I was actually on a sports radio call like not long after that happened, with a scheduled interview that I'd had on a radio station, and we're like, you know, if he's gone for any length of time here, the whole dynamic of the finals changes. Like right now, Golden State's clearly the team to beat, and then suddenly you'd be like, well, look at LeBron. Look at, you know.
Yeah, it's almost, and I don't mean to say this in a negative way. Obviously, no one wants to see anybody hurt, let alone the MVP of the league. But it was almost this odd poetic justice of, or it would have been this odd, like, poetic justice or poetic injustice of every, it feels like every single team in this postseason has had an injury affect them in one way or another, whether it was before the season began or before the playoffs began or during the playoffs. It feels like every one of them except Golden State, you know.
Yeah,
and
no,
obviously we were all happy to see him come back, but it was one of those things like, wow, this seems like there's no end in sight for these injuries.
No, and it's been a you know, you've got to have some luck if you're going to win an NBA title, and Golden State has had that. I mean, they have been in a season of like you mentioned, just, you know, starting with Westbrook and Durant and going through all these injuries of, you know, Paul George and all these guys from before the season even started through the season. Golden State's been the one team to really avoid that. Yeah. They've really had a lucky run in the sense that they get to the playoffs and they get to avoid the Clippers and the Spurs.
Yeah.
Like they're both on the other side of the bracket and they're beat each other up so bad that, you know, they don't get past Houston, and I don't want to knock Houston. They came back on the Clippers but have played with a lot of heart, but Golden State's avoided all the serious injuries, all the serious trouble, and you look ahead even towards the finals where they probably face almost certainly, you know, but probably face a Cleveland team that's got, you know, Kyrie Irving dragging a leg and no Kevin Love. It's just the whole thing has broken the right way for them, and you were like, oh no, not them too, not, you know,
yeah,
not this.
Especially with the MVP of the league. Were you
surprised he came back in this game?
I actually was. I was funny. I was just going to ask you the same thing. I really was, only because, you know, the heightened sense of awareness around concussions, specifically thanks to the NFL, you know, it's at a place where it's never been. You know, everybody, I feel like, not that they're concussion experts, but everybody's aware of what it means to have a concussion now. Fans, analysts, sideline reporters, everybody knows, you know, this isn't something you take lightly. And like you said, that for me was one of the worst falls I've seen, because he really got up. Like, he was high in the air. He fell. You see it in succession, like shoulder, neck, head. You see his head hit the ground. And, you know, the variety of injuries that he could have came away with, for one, I'm pretty sure he fell on the shooting side, his right, the right side of his body. And then you realize when you see him walking to the locker room, you're like, this isn't just something, you know, with his shoulder or his arm. You know, this is his head. Like, he looked really woozy. But you know, a fall like that, you definitely need time to kind of get your bearings right. And you know, the Warriors said he passed their concussion protocol. So I was surprised that he didn't have a concussion. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, because the Warriors said he passed the concussion protocol. They said that he didn't have one. So that shocked me. But then when you hear that they say he didn't have one, then I wasn't surprised he went back in. Because the guy wanted to play, and the Warriors cut it to 9. It was 25 at one point, and then without him, I believe they cut it to 9 a little ways into the third quarter.
Yeah, they made it. I mean, they really did. You knew the run was coming, and they really did get back. But you're right. I was surprised they came that he came back as well. I like you said, I think there's a lot of caution, as there should be, with head injuries like that, and he was clearly woozy. They do, and I think they talked about this a little on the broadcast, that they do baseline test these guys with a neurological test, usually during the preseason or something. But for somebody like Curry in particular, there's definitely a baseline so that they can go off of. And then, you know, they showed him like sprinting up and down the hall. That's part of it. Like, you've got to be able to react and not show signs after various levels of physical activity. And he's, you know, he did get through it. I feel, you know, good for him. I feel, you know, it was fortunate to have him back, because that looked like something that could have been incredibly serious. Then he gets back and it's a game, you know, it's legit at the end. They are, you know, they never quite get over the hump, but they get close. And so close, you're like, well, you know, look, it's Golden State. They're like two possessions away from just owning this thing.
Yeah.
And that's when James Harden happened. Look, that guy, look, he's had one bad game in this series. He's been phenomenal for 1, 2, and 4. He has been arguably the best player on the floor in all those games. And there wasn't anything that Golden State can do. They when he's playing like that, I'm not sure there's a good answer for him.
No, there really isn't. That guy, you know, it's funny, Kurt. James Harden, I was looking back at his tenure with the Rockets, and I realized that this was actually his first year with them out of the first round. He lost to Oklahoma City in his first year in the first round, and then he lost to Portland last year in the first round. And, you know, there was still, at least for me, I was still maybe a little bit tentative. I think he's an awesome player. Don't get me wrong. But I think there was definitely this sense of like, okay, what's the ceiling with him, not only as a player, but as the best player on a championship contending team? Like, can he be the best player on a team that wins a title? And for me, this series has slam dunked at home. The guy is taking the challenge. He's scoring. He's grabbing boards. He's distributing the ball. I think he's been, you know, it's definitely one and almost like the MVP race. It's definitely 1 and 1A with him, yeah, and Steph for who's the best player on the court any given night. And, you know, he's been awesome.
Yeah. Those questions were legitimate. You weren't alone. I mean, there was a question of how is he going to play against playoff defenses. He has struggled prior to this against, you know, defenses that loaded up on him. He took his game to it, like you said, to another level. He's been distributing. He's had a couple of just brilliant passes to Howard when the help has come. He's found open guys. He's been able to, I mean, when they took away, they did, and credit, this Golden State's the best defensive team in the NBA during the season, and they've been really good through the playoffs. They took away, especially in those first two games, his easy trips to the line, his ability to get into the paint and wreak a lot of havoc, and he killed them with step backs. I mean, his mid-range, he hit 70% of his mid-range shots through the first two games. He was just getting to the spot they'd give him and then hitting the shot, yeah, often contested. And I don't think Klay Thompson did a bad job on him. They had to switch things up. I think it was the right call. They went to Harrison Barnes now with some Andre Iguodala just to put more length on him so he take away those step backs, but he's getting in. He's attacked Barnes. He's quicker than Barnes.
Yeah.
And he's got into the paint more. And it's something that Golden State's going to have to adjust for game five. I mean, Harden and the Rockets are going to play like this again. I mean, you can say, and I will say it, I wrote a whole thing about this morning, but hey, it's not sustainable. You know, Josh Smith can't keep shooting like this. I'm not looking at the numbers right off the top of my head, but he's shooting something like 10 of 18 on threes in the closeout, you know, in their elimination games. He's 10 of 13 on contested shots those elimination games for them. He's stepped up in a way, you know, in a crazy way. Like you said, some of these guys deal with pressure. I remember years ago when it was game 7 of the NBA Finals with the Lakers and the Celtics, and who was the best player on the floor in that game? on our test.
Yeah,
like, the one guy who's mentally like, what, game seven?
Yeah,
dude, I thought it was Tuesday.
I remember that very well because, you know, growing up in Boston, I was watching that series and it was really, you know, if Kobe or Powell is the one that's kind of taking you out, you can kind of stomach it. When Ron Artest is burying like what 4 and 5 threes, it hurts.
and getting rebounds and making plays, and it was just kind of like, you know, it was the guy, and Josh Smith has that same thing where hey, Josh Smith's going to play Josh Smith's game, and he's not going to be fazed by the moment. So,
no, and he's unapologetic for it.
He's not going to sustain this, but can he sustain it for another game or two? You know, I still think, though, by the way, and we can talk about this coming up, but I still think going home, we're going to see now a different Golden State team. I think they close it out in five.
Agreed. I think we'll get to the game five. Kind of look ahead in a second, but you're right, Kurt. I think one of the things that's kind of gone not under the radar, but it's been one of those things where it's hard to predict who else is going to step up for Houston, and it needs to be somebody else.
Yeah,
you know, Josh Smith did it last game. I think Trevor Ariza's played pretty well, but it's just one of those. It's one of those things where I think they're the Dwight Harden combo. At least for me, and you could tell me if you agree, Kurt. I think has kind of been underrated in the fact that they really do have to carry this team offensively and defensively, and just hope that someone else can kind of play above their expectations for a night, and then that combination of having three players play at a semi-elite level, at least for that game, is enough to carry them along with the three-point shooting.
Yeah, although I will say this, and I mentioned this in a preview the other day, it still feels to me like Harden and Howard play next to each other and not with each other. And the brilliant Tom Haberstroh over at ESPN did a stat thing recently where he said, you know, Harden's making 40-plus passes, 48, 49 passes a game, whatever it is, during the playoffs, but only 4.1 a game of those are to Howard.
Yeah,
you would think this is, and part of it's just Howard's reluctance, but whatever's going on there with matchups, to me, Howard Harden would be just devastating pick and roll that they don't run as much as you'd think. They look at other options. It's just, to me, like, you expect one of them to go off, but they don't play off each. I mean, there have been moments. There's been Harden driving for a couple of huge alley-oops and passes to Harden, yeah. I mean, to Howard. But it's not the norm. Them playing off each other isn't the norm. It's kind of still, I don't know, feels like first year Miami where Wade and LeBron were playing next to each other and not with each other. It feels more like that to me, and I think that there's another level they can still reach.
I agree that You would think they would work in unison better because Howard is such a good role man.
Yeah.
But I think part of it is I think Harden's very good in isolation, one. And two, I think they're a little worried that, you know, when you're not purposefully hacking Dwight, you're still looking to send him to the line if he catches in the paint area, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of where I think they would rather have him look. If they're not just straight posting him up, which I think they still do a little too much, if they're not just straight posting him up, they're looking for him to kind of work the glass and try and get offensive rebounds and putbacks. Because once you throw it to him, if it's not on a lob and he's close to the rim, you're just going to foul him.
Yeah.
And he's also not the polished post player where if it's just a straight post up, they trust Andrew Bogut enough, and they even trust Draymond Green enough just to kind of contest, let him hit maybe 2 out of 5 hook shots, and that's going to be it for the whole game. So I think a little bit of it is their contrast in styles, and that Harden's a very good – he's a great passer, but he's also an awesome isolation player.
Yeah.
And I also think it's a little bit of coaching in that they don't really call that a lot, but they also don't want Dwight to be sent to the line, you know, 14, 16 times a game.
Yeah, and Howard isn't really, and you can ask Mike D'Antoni about this, isn't a fan of doing the pick and roll, even though he is vastly more efficient at it than he is at post-ups and other plays. it's not something he's going to demand to be in that much or call his own number. He's not that eager to do it. And I don't know, look, I don't know where that comes from other than the whole macho Shaq, well, just give him the ball in the post thing where they, you know, that worked in a different era in modern NBA where you can, you know, zone up and bring the help much earlier, if not before the ball gets there. It's, you know, you can't just run through the post the same way anymore.
No, and it's funny, too, because you can correct me if I'm wrong, but he did a lot of pick and roll in Orlando.
Yeah, a lot more of it. Yeah, and I think Stan forced him to.
Yeah.
Stan's a smart cookie, I think that was – I don't know if that's part of where his distaste came from or something, but it's if you've got him, you know, it was Howard and that pick and roll with Turkoglu or with Jameer Nelson and then space the floor with shooters and – that got him to an NBA Finals, man.
Yeah, agreed. I think I definitely still think Howard can at least be the second best player on a championship team. It's just, you know, that the weakness of the foul shooting is just so evident that it's tough to keep him on the floor sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look back at where Houston was in these playoffs. And look, it's Daryl Morey. He'll probably go big game hunting this summer anyway. But I think that's one of the things I've come away with is that Howard's still good. Howard's still a very good big man. But he's the number two or three guy, like you said, on this team. If they have, I mean, yes, they were injured. They certainly in this series could have used Patrick Beverley for the defensive reasons. You know, they're missing Monta Ellis, but that team needs one more guy who can create with the ball in his hands.
Absolutely.
As a six-man role or whatever. But if they had and I'm not saying they're going to get him, but if they had a Jamal Crawford type where they just somebody that could light it up off the bench and create offense, they'd be far more dangerous.
Agreed. Howard, I thought Howard didn't get enough pub for his last three games against the Clippers. I'm looking at his box score right now. He went 20-15, 20-21, 16-15 games 5, 6,
wow.
And 7. That's just awesome.
Yeah, he put up numbers. And like I said, I actually did this post earlier today. Trevor Ariza knocked down a ridiculous amount of threes. When they've got their backs against the wall, guys step up for that team, and it's not going to be an easy closeout probably for Golden State. I think they're going to have to work for it a little bit. They may pull away at some point, you know, middle of the third quarter or start of the fourth or something and stretch, but it's not going to be a game three situation. I think they're going to have to work for it.
I want to get your thoughts on something because one of the big things that's become is at the forefront of the NBA right now is this three-point revolution,
yeah.
Right? Like everybody's talking about how, you know, the three-point shot is just, is at the end of the day a better, more efficient shot. And I'm still on the fence a little bit. I absolutely buy into the importance of three-point shooting. I just think that you can't look at certain teams or players when you're evaluating that shot only because it's like anything else. You have to look at the mean. You can't look at the extremes of that shot. And I think these two teams kind of represent that pretty well. First off, I think there's a slight misconception with Houston. I mean, I know they put up a ton of threes, and I'm pretty sure didn't they set Houston and Golden State last night set the record for most three-pointers
most
made?
Most threes in a playoff, attempted, yeah. Attempted or made, but yes.
I believe it was made.
Made. I think it was 37 made threes between the two of them in one game.
Yeah, but first off, the top dog Harden, he can shoot from three, and he was awesome last night from three. He was 7 of 11, so more than half of his field goals were threes. But when you watch that guy play, I think his dribble drive pull up game is what makes him such a dangerous offensive player, and that's a mid range shot. But it's so unguardable, it puts whoever's defending him one on one. And basically a no man's land type of situation. I think it's his ability to force the drive, force your back pedal, and then step back on a dime and hit that mid-range shot that makes him such a dangerous player. I think that's the best weapon he has in his arsenal.
Yeah, well, and the ability to – he can pull that out at any time or put his head down and just kind of be a bowling ball going through the lane and get the foul
get to the line.
Get to the line, and that – combination of you've got to be ready for that, and you've got to kind of play him with your arms almost back a little bit so you don't get that foul and you can't reach, and then he pulls that step back out. And if you fear him going down the lane and you give him a little space, like you said, he's an off-the-bounce little pull-up three guy who will knock it down. I mean, he's got such a varied game. I think, look, Phil Jackson wasn't wrong when he started to correct himself the other day, in the sense that you've still got to have penetration in today's game. You've still got to work inside out a little bit. It can't be – no. And I don't think – when you look at the teams that are left, when you're talking about Houston and Golden State putting up all these threes, both of these teams penetrate. Both of these teams get the ball inside out. They don't do it in a traditional throw-it-into-the-post kind of way.
No, it's drive and kick.
But yeah, exactly. But it's not like they're – You don't have to worry about penetration from them, that they're only shooting threes, which is, I don't know, Phil suggested that, but I don't think any good team is doing, you know, nobody's really doing that. You've got specialists who stand out there looking for that kick, but they're not, you know, you've still got to have a little inside out. You've got to have a threat inside, and these teams certainly do. I think it's the question of value, and that's what it comes back to. You know, the most efficient shot in the game remains the dunk or the layup, you know, something right at the rim like that.
Yep.
But the three is, especially the corner threes, are second to that. And if you are valuing in your offense a 15-foot, you know, free throw line jump shot over a three, that's where I think things go sideways. And then, but you've got to count personnel into this. You mentioned Harden. Harden is a fantastic mid-range shooter. If you have Dirk Nowitzki, and he wants to shoot some mid-range shots, you know what you do? You let him.
Yeah,
he eats that little step-back three, and it might as well, not step-back three, but that little one-legged step-back 17, 18-foot fadeaway, that's a layup for him. I mean, it's you will let him take as many of those as he can get off. There are certain guys that are exceptions to that rule, and there are others around the league, but in general, it's about getting guys to their strong spots on the floor. And, you know, look, if Kobe gets the elbow jumper, you let him take it, but you value the three more. If you're giving up good for great, which the best teams do, the Spurs did. You know, it's a funny thing about Phil's comment, like these 3-point shooting teams. I mean, did you watch the finals the last 3 years?
Oh my God.
Did you watch Miami and then San Antonio last year? Those teams used the three for that reason. They both played inside out. They both had the threat, but you've got to have that, both that floor spacing and those, that extra, the guys who can knock down that shot for the extra point.
Agreed. And I think I agree with one of the things you said is that, you know, it's about your personnel. And I think it's not, the thing that frustrates me with the conversation about 3-point shooting is this notion that you need to just like jack them up. And that's not what it is. You need to work them into the framework of your offense. You need to build an offense where you're looking the one of the open shots, or some of the open shots you're looking for, are 3-point shots. Because when you're building an offensive system, it's about where you want your shots to come from and how you get them there. It's not just necessarily, oh, we're gonna take this shot here and this shot here. You know, we're gonna take at least 5 corner threes a game. Like, that's not really how it works. You can say, we want to run, we have these sets designed to get this person a shot in this area. But it's not as simple as, okay, we have a shot chart. We need this many threes from this area, this many threes from this area, and we'll win. You know, when you look at shot charts and stats, you know, things, you know, patterns begin to develop where you realize, oh, when we get this many shots here, we tend to have more offensive success. But that doesn't necessarily mean then you force those shots. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, no, they've got to come organically through the flow of the offense, and you've got to have something that gets that guy that look.
Exactly.
Whether it's something he can, you know, there are guys, you know, Steph Curry or whoever, who can create really well off the bounce, but for a lot of guys, it's about getting them in a matchup or a situation they favor in their strong spots on the floor. And frankly, that's something the best coaches have done for a long time. Phil Jackson was a master at that, and you know, I've always said Phil Jackson's greatest gift was getting guys to buy into what he wanted to do in terms of those kind of things, but making them think it was their own idea.
Yeah.
Because if it's your own idea, and this is true, look, at work or anybody's work or anything, if it's your idea, you've got some buy-in.
Yeah, but you're invested.
More than if it's your boss's idea, and Phil was just the master at making you think it was your own idea to do exactly what he wanted you to do.
That's a good point. And another Another thing with the three-point shot, I feel like you can't, for me at least, I almost can't even evaluate the shot itself when I'm watching Golden State because they are just so much better than, like, Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, they are just so much better at that shot specifically than any other backcourt. Steph Curry as a player is probably, at least for me, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but he is the best off-the-dribble three-point shooter I've ever seen already. So it's kind of hard for me to say, well, yeah, Golden State, they're a better team because of the threes they take. And it's like, yes and no. Obviously, that helps their offense, but you can't judge. It's almost like you can't judge the value of that shot when the people taking him are that much better than the rest of the league at that shot.
Exactly. Steph Curry's, and you nailed it. I mean, he's as good or better than anybody I can ever remember off the bounce at the three. Plus, he's really good at the catch and shoot. By the way, how does Houston keep losing him off the ball?
Yeah, I mean, it's really
happened
bad.
Again in the last game it makes you appreciate what Mike Conley did. Mike Conley was in his jersey in the last series off the ball.
It's called Jason Terry.
I think your point is valid. It's like, yeah, Golden State's a three-point shooting, you know, relies heavily on that weapon. Look at the guys on their roster. Yeah. They should be relying on that weapon.
It's insane. I remember it was I think 3 years ago, maybe. It was either 2 or 3 years ago. It was the series where Golden State played the Spurs, and I believe the second round.
2 years ago,
And this is before I had watched the Golden State Warriors sparingly, but I had never, like, really focused and, like, paid attention to just how great they were. And I remember I was having a conversation with a friend of mine at work, and we were debating about the Warriors, and I was like, I've seen Steph Curry play, and he's great, but, man, like, I don't know if you can – you can win just relying on that shot. And then I like really started watching that series and I was in awe. I completely took it back. I was like, that guy is amazing at that.
Yeah.
Like, not only at 3-point shooting, but dribble drive, passing, like, that dude can absolutely play. And if he is that good at shooting that shot, then you can absolutely win with it.
Yeah. By the way, they call, if you talk to Golden State people, they credit that series as one of their real learning block, one of the real steps forward for them as a franchise in terms of just the guys on the, you know, you've got to, I still subscribe to the theory a little bit in the NBA that you have to lose a little to win.
Yeah.
And they look back at that series as a big learning step for them. So
they could have won it. Manu Ginobili hit a game-winning three, and I think like game four or five, they could have won it.
Yeah, no, they were right there, and I think, like I said, I think that they look back and realized how good they could be coming out of that. I think it was one of those big step forward for them, so. So I think we seem to be on the same page here for Game 5 in this one.
Yeah, I think the Warriors win it heading home. What are you looking at from the Golden State side specifically for Game 5?
Getting the ball movement back and getting I don't want to say they came out thinking, hey, we got Game 5 at home, but they gave a little life to Houston. I think that they are going to do sort of what the Clippers, I mean, remember, the Clippers were up 19.
Yeah. They should have won that game.
Yeah. I think you're going to see that kind of effort from them. I expect Houston, look, they're going to still fight. They're still going to knock down some shots, but I think you're going to see Golden State come out with a lot more energy, get some sort of a lead, but they'll be, it may not be up to 19, but they'll get, you know, if they get a lead in the 8 or 10, I just don't think they're going to, Steve Kerr will reference this more than once, plus I just think they're a deeper team. They're not going to get exhausted like the Clippers did at the end of that. I don't think they're going to lose the lead. But I think they're going to hold on.
Yeah, I think despite the loss for Golden State, I think there were some positive signs that heading into Game 5. You know, for one, I know I was a little critical of Klay Thompson his last couple games going into this, or in this series at least. You know, he wasn't really shooting well. He was really struggling from three. And he had a really good game. You know, part of the reason they cut it to 9 was because he started letting it fly. I think he went on an 8-0 run by himself.
Yeah, but he did. And he's not exhausted covering James Harden.
Yeah.
You know, they're switching that up. They're putting that he's got a little time on him, but not near as much. And they're letting Harrison Barnes handle that. And that, look, it's exhausting to cover James Harden. So
absolutely.
His legs just weren't there. I think that that's just part of it. But yeah, he's got his legs back, and suddenly the Splash Brothers are back.
Yeah, went 6 of 13 from three. Before that, he was 4 of 22 in the series. So I thought that was a great sign. Found his rhythm, hit down some shots, and the willingness to take them. You know, when Steph Curry went down, it was kind of like, okay, Clay, you're the max. You're a max guy. Like, let's see you at least try and buoy this team. And he did. You know,
yeah, he
accepted that. He accepted that challenge, and he took the shots to at least make it competitive again.
I agree. I think that this is a situation where I think Golden State will get the win, but having watched Houston, they will not let it be easy on them. So
no,
we could start. I guess we need to. We need to talk about the other series here as well as they head into Game 4 tonight, Cleveland and Atlanta. But if everybody's talking in that series, and by the way, the other thing that could happen in Game 5, I'm not shocked now if we need to get into both of these plays. Dwight Howard's not there. Dwight Howard got a flagrant one, and I, by the way, in my book, that was the right call, a flagrant one for the kind of elbow to Andrew Bogut's head.
Yep.
But if you're going to use what happened to Al Horford, that a call play that the league backed where Dellavedova kind of was in his, you know, rolled up, and I don't think it was malicious, but rolled up into his knee, and that's the couple of guys that he's kind of rolled up on that team.
Yeah.
There was a little retaliation from Horford. He gets tossed for this.
Yeah.
If that's the benchmark, and the league backed that call, then you've got to give Howard a flagrant two. And by the way, if he gets a flagrant two, he's suspended for Game 5.
Yeah.
He has already got – you can't get more than 4 flagrant points. You get 1 for a flagrant 1, 2 for a flagrant 2. When you get to 4, you're suspended a game in the playoffs. He's at 2. If this is a flagrant 2, he's got to sit out a game. That makes me think the league won't do it.
Agreed.
But if they're going to be consistent, they have to.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I don't think the league will do it only because, you know, we want objectivity, right? We want unbiased, you know, opinions and decisions. But that in and of itself is virtually impossible to be completely objective, especially when you're dealing with, you know, businessmen making decisions when they want to not hurt the competitive spirit of a series.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
exactly.
I think that in order for them to overturn certain calls, they have to be absolutely egregious. And I'm specifically, we can get into the Dellie play, but specifically with the Howard play, I agreed with the flagrant one, and I don't think it should be upgraded for a couple of reasons. And again, you know, it's tough when you kind of hash these things out because you have the letter of the law of the flagrant foul one and the flagrant foul two rule, but then you also kind of get the sense that, you know, there is this kind of their unwritten mitigating factors, right? Like, for example, with the Howard play specifically, Howard, you know, and this goes back for big men for years, but that dude takes a beating, and he whines a lot and he complains for calls a lot, but he definitely takes a beating, and Andrew Bogut knows it, and Andrew Bogut knows that if he can kind of instigate Howard and throw him off his game, it's way more important for Bogut to kind of take those risks than Howard, and he did the play in question. He arm locks him. He two-hand shoves him. Like, that is not a basketball play. He physically two-hand shoves Howard. Howard rears back, and he flings the elbow and arm. It looks like he catches him with the elbow, and then the forearm kind of extends the contact.
Yeah.
I think the fact that he had an open fist kind of helped him because he didn't – it looked like with the hand contact, it looked more like a slap than a full-on punch. Like, I saw a lot of people were comparing it to the J.R. Smith play, which I can see those comparisons, but I thought J.R. Smith's swing was 10 times more violent, and he swung with with a closed fist.
And I also, J.R. Smith had a lot more intent behind his.
Absolutely, but then the letter of the law also doesn't – the letter of the law in terms of flagrant twos never says the word intent, but like I said, every referee that looks at those plays, whether they want to admit it or not, whether it's subconscious or not, they look at intent. Like, it's obvious. Intent stares you in the face. Like, you can't just ignore it. Like, I think the fact that we call for that, like, yeah, I get it, but it's a little unrealistic. Like, it's when you see J.R. Smith rear back and backfist Jay Crowder in the face, and the guy buckles and goes down. It's a little different than Howard kind of flinging a chicken wing out there. Granted, he made contact, and you know, by the letter of the law, if you wanted to explain to me, like, in a vacuum, is that a flagrant two? I could buy it, but it's not in a vacuum. It's a game five of the Western Conference Finals. Like, that's just is what it is. That's a fact.
Well, and that's why I had issue with the call, the Delly call on Horford, which was that I think it was a reaction, and to take that context away, both the history with Dellavedova and how the Hawks team felt about him after the Korver play,
yeah.
And then a guy kind of at his knees. I thought Horford should have got a flagrant one. I don't think he should have been tossed from the game.
Agreed.
To me, it's sort of the same situation. He was frustrated, and he for a second he kind of retaliated, but it wasn't in a way that I thought deserved the ejection he got. But I knew when I saw when it happened, and then I watched them go over, and I hadn't really thought about it before. Then I watched them go over to watch the tape. I'm like, oh, it's Maurer and Brothers. He's gone.
Yeah.
Like, and it comes down to the officiating crew, and it's why I think Jeff Van Gundy talked about this a little on the broadcast last night, and I think he's spot on. There's been people around the league I know calling for this, which is the next step for them with the replay center is to have one person in Secaucus for these, and not just every night. I mean, not one person every night, but a handful of people who get to make those calls outside the emotion of that arena.
Agreed.
Because I right now it's look, the NBA, you know, ejection foul, you know, flagrant foul system / following fines just feels like roulette. Like,
yep.
You just never know.
Agreed. I thought that was a great point by Van Gundy, that you have someone completely independent. They can't feel the crowd. They don't feel the emotion of the game. And it's what they focus on specifically. That's their job. They evaluate flagrant fouls. So they don't have to think about, you know, well, Howard's been hacked five times this game, or LeBron just got shoved like two plays earlier. It's no. This play specifically and how I evaluate flagrant fouls. I thought it was a great point.
Yeah, because and he's right about this, and this is something everybody's complained about in not just NBA officiating, but I mean NHL, NBA, you know, NFL, whatever. All anybody wants is consistency.
Yeah.
And when it comes to flagrants right now, the NBA isn't consistent. I don't think, like I said, I was pretty clear. I don't think Horford should have gotten tossed. I it's going to be interesting to see how the league deals with this, only because of the consistency factor. I don't want to see Howard out for that game, but it's going to be interesting. The league did not, by the way, decide that there would be no extra punishment for Horford. You know, which is a sign that they both realized that they want him around for the next game. And I guess the question is, if he's back, is that, and they're on the road, is that enough? Did Cleveland, even without Horford, lose their one chance to get a win in this series?
You mean Atlanta?
Not Cleveland. I mean Atlanta lose their chance to get a win in this series.
Yeah, agreed. When I watched the Horford play, I was like you. I saw it and I thought flagrant one, but I could absolutely see the refs calling it flagrant two, and I could see them justifying it within the context of the rule. I wouldn't be upset as an objective viewer. I'd be a little upset as an NBA fan that wants to see a good game because Horford was playing well and Atlanta needed a win. But just purely from an objective standpoint, I could buy it because you know, shout out to the internet, because the memes about The Rock throwing a people's elbow were absolutely perfect. Like he absolutely wound up and tried to drop it home. Luckily, he didn't hit Dellavedova square. But I think this leads into a conversation that's been going on since that play about, you know, what constitutes a dirty play, what constitutes a dirty player, where's the line, where do you draw it? And you know, Dellavedova, you know, fair, unfair, you know, that's up to, you know, your own personal opinion to decide. He's become the poster boy for that conversation. And it's funny because he's had the three incidents, right? The Taj Gibson, the Kyle Korver, and the Al Horford. For me, the most egregious one was the Taj Gibson one, because it was just so out of the context of the play. There was nothing going on. He just leg locks a guy because he's trying to piss him off and he's trying to hold him up. Taj tries to shake his leg free and give a little oomph, and he gets kicked out, and Dele gets nothing. It's like, come on. He didn't even get a T for that. I thought that was the most egregious one. Second was the Horford one, because in my opinion, I thought that play was a little dirtier. I don't want to paint Dellavedova with a broad brush, but I thought it was a little dirtier than people were letting on, only because I feel like those athletes have better body control than people give them credit for. And he was visibly backpedaling into the knees of Horford, which is a big no-no. And then the Korver one resulted in the worst injury, but I thought that was just – it was a reckless play, but it was a hustle play. I don't think there was any malice behind it.
I think Dellavedova plays on the edge. You know, the term you hear a lot with him is the sneaky dirty.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys who's – I mean, it's not – you know, he's not doing things blatantly intentional, but he plays – look, he plays hard. He's the kind of guy you like on your team. He plays right up to the edge, and sometimes he kind of crosses that line a little bit. But that's, you know, that's becoming the rep around the league on him. And however you wish to define it, I don't know that I'd call him dirty, but he certainly plays on that edge. I mean, is Matt Barnes dirty, or does he just kind of you know, play with a lot of attitude? You know, it's.
But the thing with Matt Barnes is he gets fined. Like, he has ramifications.
Even
when he doesn't do anything, he's getting fined.
he's one of those guys now who are like, and he'll joke. I wouldn't even say jokes, but with this kind of frustrated edge about it when you talk to him, like, yeah, I can't like breathe near an official.
Yeah, he gets fined for hand checks. So, you know, that's the difference. Dele is, I think, out of all three of those plays, he's come away with one technical foul. So,
yeah.
I think that's also part of the frustration is he's kind of getting away with it.
Yeah.
How do you rank in terms of those three plays? What was the most egregious to you?
Yeah, I think you're right in the sense that it was the Gibson one, because that was the other two. Look, he was scrapping on the ground. Yeah, he fell into Horford's knee a little bit, but he was kind of scrapping on the ground. There was some stuff going on there. The Korver one, again, reckless is the way you use the word. That's the word I like for describing that play. It wasn't an intent to injure or knock a guy out like that. And he may need surgery and he may be gone for a while now.
Yeah.
I don't think that came with full intent, but it was reckless in a league where, Horford used the word, look, there's a little bit of there's a brotherhood here. And there is, in the sense that nobody wants to knock a guy's career, you know, mm-hmm. You're not trying to injure other guys. And he was reckless about that. But Gibson, I mean, like you said, that one, I just never understood that call. That call made no sense to me. In again, with any bit of context, if you watch the video and you see the leg lock and you see a little frustration with the kick afterwards, yeah, but he locked the guy's leg up.
Yeah.
I mean, so
even if you're going to give Gibson a flagrant two, you got to give Dele something.
Yeah, exactly. It was just an odd call, odd situation. But I think that's who he is. He's out there partially just trying to get under everybody's skin, you know?
Yeah. And to his credit, you know, he's a good player. He tries harder than probably a good 75-80% of the league when he gets his minutes, you know? Like, he wants to perform, and with Kyrie Irving out, he's played well. It's just one of those guys that flirts with that line a little bit. And, you know, it's funny because has anybody ever openly said, like, I think this player is a dirty player? Because
– yeah, no, exactly.
You know, it's when you get, like, post-game reaction or even, like, you know, when they ask David Blatt, like, there's a pattern of behavior. It's like, dude, what do you think he's going to say? Like, yeah.
Exactly.
You know? Like,
yeah, no, he's going to stick up for his guy. Yeah, it's hard to – outside of, you know – and there's times, like, Kendrick Perkins is coming in. You're like, oh, here comes the enforcer. But, you know – I think everybody knows. Do you see any chance of the Hawks winning game four, or do you think that they're done?
I think they're done only because, you know, LeBron's is just playing. Absolutely. It's hard to say another level because this is, like, what we always see from him. Like, he is always this good, but it's just he doesn't cease to amaze or impress, you know?
Like,
and we were talking about this a little bit before. that Delhi play kind of overshadowed one of LeBron's best playoff games ever in his whole career. He started off 0-for-10. He finished with 37 points, 18 rebounds, and 13 assists.
Like, yeah, and he was he was ice cold to start that game and just not there. And he still found a way, and he's carrying so much of a load with this offense right now. This is just the Hawks. The Cavaliers, just because of injuries, you know, because of everything going on, there's no Kyrie Irving, there's no Kevin Love, there's no obvious, you know, they don't have their second ball handler out there, and so he's got to create everything. He's key for them defensively, and he's exhausted at the end of these games. He is putting out so much to get so much energy. He's doing everything he can, and I thought that you're right, that this was one of his better playoff games in a long time. It was absolutely not as pretty.
Yeah,
but in terms of just grit and effort and grinding a team to a win, he was phenomenal. And I feel for the Hawks. I think that was the Hawks' chance. I got a feeling you're going to see a Cavaliers team in this game that just, look, we're due for another night where J.R. Smith knocks down some shots or somebody else does. I think
that's becoming the norm.
Yeah, I know.
For as much as a knucklehead as that guy is, man, he can shoot it. He's a very good player.
Yeah, he'll have his off nights and his moments, but I think that they use him a little more wisely than the Knicks did, which isn't saying much, frankly. I think that's kind of what you're seeing here. I think he's developed into at least a reliable enough next option to get them through for now. And you know, I think it'll be interesting to see. You know, I'm assuming that they make the finals. Kyrie will play, but you know it's concerning that he had like a week off before this series, dragged his leg around in game one, and has now missed the next two. I'm not a doctor, but is this really tendonitis or is there more going on here? Because tendonitis tends to get better with rest, and this really just hasn't.
Yeah, I think you're right. It absolutely wouldn't shock me if there was more to it.
It just seems odd, and you know, we will get into this down the line. Our next podcast probably should be out Thursday, and we by then may know who's in the finals and be talking about looking forward to that, starting to look forward to that. We'll have plenty of time for that since the league does. It was interesting this year; they talked about moving the finals up a couple days, but I'll tell you, as somebody who's gone to these, you normally get a couple of dates. You normally get the finals will start this day, or you know, something along those lines.
Yeah.
Not this time. It was from the start of the season. It's like the finals will start June 4th.
Yeah, exactly.
Were locked into that, and then they had these playoffs, and they're like, "Man, now we got a week."
Yeah. Right. Now we can. Yeah. Because. Yeah, and that's something like you said we'll get to down the line, but these series haven't been as competitive as we've hoped for, especially out of conference.
No, not at all. And I think that part of it's just the way things broke. We've had great series. We had Clippers Spurs.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't think we expected that in the first round. And I think in the West, honestly, I genuinely believe that that series happening in the first round impacted the Rockets being able to get past the Clippers in the next round. Oh, yeah. I don't know if the Rockets pulled that off in the first round.
The entire conference. It affected the entire
having those two teams on the same side of the bracket changed everything. And it changed the competitiveness of some of the series. And then the East is the East.
Yeah.
The East is East, but I mean there's also injuries, you know, John Wall's injury and stuff that did just change the dynamics out there. So
completely agree.
But, yeah, I think I expect that this is going to be it. I think game four will probably be it. I think Cleveland will close out, and then they'll have a ton of time off. And we'll see. It'll be interesting. You know, we'll talk about it going forward. It's going to be interesting to see what they think they can bring against Golden State, because I think Golden State presents a ton of problems for them. We're going to talk a lot about the finals and everything else coming up down the line. We're going to keep checking us out with the PBT podcast. We're going to be back now through the playoffs. We are going to have a lot of guests on here. You're going to hear from Dan and Brett and the other guys with PBT, as well as you're going to hear from guests about the draft coming up, draft experts. We're going to have guys in talking about free agency for specific teams, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We are going to be back as well for all of these. I'm Kurt Heelan. You can follow me at Basketball Talk on Twitter. And Dom, your Twitter handle for everybody is?
At DL Riddy, R-I-D-D-Y.
Great basketball fan, great guy with NBC Sports. And check us out. We'll be back Thursday. We'll be back throughout the playoffs. Thanks for listening.